The geologist, Rankin, was standing beside Streeter. On seeing Hatch, he grinned and strode over, crushing Hatch's hand in a great hairy paw. "Hey, Dr. Hatch," he said, white teeth flashing through an enormous beard, his long brown hair plaited behind. "Man, this is one fascinating island you've got." Hatch had already heard several variants of this remark from other Thalassa employees. "Well, I guess that's why we're all here," he answered with a smile.
"No, no, I mean geologically."
"Really? I always thought it was like the others. Just a big granite rock in the ocean." Rankin dug into a pocket of his rain vest and pulled out what looked like a handful of granola.
"Hell no,"
he munched.
"Granite? It's biotite schist, highly metamorphosed, checked, and faulted to an incredible degree. And with a drumlin on top. Wild, man, just wild."
"Drumlin?"
"A really weird kind of glacial hill, pointed at one side and tapered at the other. No one knows how they form, but if I didn't know better, I'd say..."
"Divers, get ready," came Needleman's voice over the radio. "All stations, check in by the numbers."
"Monitoring station, Roger," squawked the voice of Magnuson.
"Computer station, Roger," said Wapner, sounding bored and annoyed even over the radio. "Spotter Alpha, Roger. Spotter Beta, Roger. Spotter Gamma, Roger. Naiad, Roger," Streeter spoke into the radio. "Grampus affirms," came Needleman's voice. "Proceed to position." As the Naiad picked up speed beneath him, Hatch checked his watch. 8:20. The tide would turn shortly. As he stowed his medical kit, the two divers came out of the cabin, laughing at some private joke. One was a man, tall and slender, with a black mustache. He wore a wetsuit of thin neoprene so tight it left no anatomical feature to the imagination. The other, a woman, turned and saw Hatch. A playful smile appeared on her lips.
"Ah, you are the mysterious doctor."
"I didn't know I was mysterious," said Hatch.
"But this is the dreaded island of Dr. Hatch, no?" she said, pointing, with a peal of laughter. "I hope you will not be hurt if I avoid your services."
"I hope you avoid them, too," said Hatch, trying to think of something less inane to say. Drops of water glistened on her olive skin, and her hazel eyes sparkled with little flecks of gold. She couldn't be more than 25, Hatch decided. Her accent was exotic, French, with a touch of the islands thrown in.
"I am Isabelle Bonterre," she said,
pulling off her neoprene glove and holding out her hand. Hatch took it. It was cool and wet.
"What a hot hand you have," she cried.
"The pleasure is mine," Hatch replied belatedly.
"And you are the brilliant Harvard doctor that Gerard has been talking about," she said, gazing into his face. "He likes you very much, you know."
Hatch found himself blushing. Glad to hear it. He had never really thought about whether Needleman liked him, but he found himself unaccountably pleased to hear it. He caught, just out of the corner of his eye, a glance of hatred from Streeter.
"I am glad you are aboard. It saves me the trouble of tracking you down."
Hatch frowned his lack of understanding.
"I will be locating the old pirate encampment, excavating it."
She gave him a shrewd look.
"You own this island, no? Where would you camp, if you had to spend 3 months on it?"
Hatch thought for a moment. "Originally, the island was heavily wooded in spruce and oak. I imagine they would have cut a clearing on the leeward side of the island, on the shore, near where their boats were moored."
"The lee shore? But would that not mean they could be seen from the mainland on clear days?"
"Well, I suppose so, yes. This coast was already settled in 1696, though sparsely."
"And they would need to keep watch on the windward shore, Nisba, for any shipping that might chance on them?"
"Yes, that's right," Hatch said, secretly nettled.
If she knows all the answers, then why is she asking me? The main shipping route between Halifax and Boston went right past here, across the Gulf of Maine. He paused. But if this coast was settled, how would they have hidden 9 ships?
I too thought of that question. There is a very deep harbor 2 miles up the coast, shielded by an island.
Black Harbor, said Hatch.
Exactement.
That makes sense, Hatch replied. Black Harbor wasn't settled until the mid-1700s. The work crew and McCallum could have lived on the island, while the ships sheltered unseen in the harbor.
The windward side, then, Bonterre said. You've been most helpful. Now I must get ready.
Any lingering annoyance Hatch felt melted away under the archaeologist's dazzling smile. She balled up her hair and slid the hood over it, then donned her mask. The other diver sidled over to adjust her tanks, introducing himself as Sergio Scopatti. Bonterre glanced up and down the man's suit appraisingly, as if seeing it for the first time.
"Grand mère de noir," she muttered fervently. "I did not know Speedo made wetsuits."
"Italians make everything fashionable," Scopatti laughed. "And molto spelta."
"How's my video working?"
Bonterre called over her shoulder to Streeter, tapping a small camera mounted on her mask. Streeter ran his hand down a bank of switches, and a video screen popped to life on the control console, showing the jiggling, grinning face of Scopatti.
"Look somewhere else," said Scopatti to Bonterre, "or you'll break your camera." "I shall look at the doctor, then," said Bonterre, and Hatch saw his own face appear on the screen.
"That wouldn't just break the camera, it would implode the lens," Hatch said, wondering why this woman kept him at a loss for words.
"Next time, I get the comm set," said Scopatti in a joking whine. "Never," said Bonterre. "I am the famous archaeologist. You are just cheap hired Italian labor."
Scopatti grinned, not at all put out. Needleman's voice broke in. 5 minutes to the turn of the tide. Is the Naiad in position?" Streeter acknowledged. "Mr. Wapner, is the program running properly?"
"No problemo, Captain," came the nasal voice over the channel. "Running fine now. Now that I'm here, I mean."
"Understood. Dr. Magnusson."
"The pumps are primed and ready to go, Captain.
The crew reports that the dive bomb is suspended over the water pit and the remote's in place." "Excellent. Dr. Magnusson, you'll drop the bomb on my signal." The people on the Naiad fell silent. A pair of guillemots whirred past, flying just above the surface of the water. On the far side of the island, Hatch could make out the Grampus, riding the even swell just beyond the ledges. The air of excitement, of something about to happen, increased. "Mean high tide," came Needleman's quiet voice. "Start the pumps." The throb of the pumps came rumbling across the water. As if in response, the island groaned and coughed with the reversal of the tide. Hatch shuddered involuntarily. If there was one thing that still gave him a shiver of horror, it was that sound.
"Pumps at 10,
came Magnusson's voice. "Keep it steady. Mr. Wapner."
"Charybdis responding normally, Captain. All systems within normal tolerances."
"Very well," said Needleman. "Let's proceed. Naiad, are you ready?"
"Affirmative," said Streeter into the mic.
"Hold steady and keep an eye out for the spot where the die appears. Spotters ready." There was another chorus of eyes. Looking toward the island, Hatch could see several teams ranged along the bluffs with binoculars. "First one who spots the die gets a bonus." "All right. Release the die bomb." There was a momentary silence, then a faint crump sounded from the vicinity of the water pit.
"Die released," said Magnusson.
All hands peered across the gently undulating surface of the ocean. The water had a dark, almost black color, but there was no wind and only the faintest chop, making conditions ideal. Despite the growing rip current,
Streeter kept the boat stationary with an expert handling of the throttles. A minute passed, and another, the only sound the throb of the pumps pouring seawater into the water pit, driving the dye down into the heart of the island and out to sea. Bonterre and Scapati waited in the stern, silent and alert.
"Dye at 22 degrees,"
came the urgent voice of one of the spotters on the island.
140 feet offshore."
"Naiad, that's your quadrant," said Needleman. "The Grampus will come over to assist. Well done." A small cheer erupted over the frequency.
"That's the spot I saw the whirlpool," Hatch thought.
Streeter swung the boat around, gunning the engine, and in a moment Hatch could see a light spot on the ocean about 300 yards away. Both Bonterre and Sergio had their masks and regulators in place and were already at the gunwales, bolt guns in their hands and buoys at their belts, ready to go over the side.
"Dye at 297 degrees, 100 feet offshore," came the voice of another spotter, cutting through the cheering.
"What?" came Needleman's voice. "You mean to say that dye is appearing in another place?"
"Affirmative, Captain."
There was a moment of shocked silence. "Looks like we've got 2 flood tunnels to seal," said Needleman. "The Grampus will mark the second. Let's go." The Naiad was closing in on the swirl of yellow dye breaking the surface just inside the reefs. Streeter cut the throttle and sent the boat in a circling idle as the divers went over the side. Hatch turned eagerly to the screens, shoulder to shoulder with Rankin. At first the video image consisted only of clouds of yellow dye. Then the picture cleared. A large, rough crack appeared at the murky bottom of the reef, dye jetting out of it like smoke.
"Les voilà,"
came Bonterre's excited voice over the comm channel. The image jiggled wildly as she swam toward the crack, shot a small explosive bolt into the rock nearby, and attached an inflatable buoy. It bobbed upward, and Hatch looked over the rail in time to see its surface, a small solar cell and antenna bobbing at its top.
"Marked," said Bonterre. "Preparing to set charges."
"Look at that,"
breathed Rankin, swiveling his gaze from the video to the sonar and back again.
"A radiating fault pattern. All they had to do was tunnel along existing fractures in the rock. Still, incredibly advanced for 17th-century construction."
"Dye at 5 degrees, 90 feet offshore," came another call.
"Are you certain?"
Disbelief mixed with uncertainty in Needleman's voice. "Okay, we've got a 3rd tunnel. Naiad, it's yours. Spotters, for God's sake, keep your scopes trained in case the dye spreads before we can get to it."
"More dye! 332 degrees, 70 feet offshore."
And then the first voice again.
"Dye appearing at 85 degrees. I repeat, 85 degrees, 40 feet offshore."
"We'll take the one at 332, said Needleman, a strange tone creeping into his voice. "Just how many tunnels did this bloody architect build?"
"Streeter, that makes 2 for you to deal with. Get your divers up as soon as possible. Just mark the exits for now, and we'll set the plastique later. We've only got 5 minutes before that dye dissipates."
In another moment, Bonterre and Scapati were up and in the boat, and without a word, Streeter spun the wheel and took off at a roar. Now Hatch could see another cloud of yellow dye boiling to the surface. The boat circled as Bonterre and Scapati went over the side. Soon another buoy had popped up. The divers emerged, and the Naiad moved to the spot where the 3rd cloud of dye was appearing. Again Bonterre and Scapati went over the side, and Hatch turned his attention to the video screen. Scapati swam ahead, his form visible in Bonterre's headset, a ghostly figure among the billowing clouds of dye. They were already deeper than at any point on the 2 dives. Suddenly, the jagged rocks at the bottom of the reef became visible, along with a square opening, much larger than the others, through which the last tendrils of dye were now drifting.
"What's this?"
Hatch heard Bonterre say in a voice of disbelief.
"Sergio, Eton."
Suddenly Wapner's voice crackled over the radio.
"Got a problem, Captain."
"What is it?" Needleman responded.
"Dunno. I'm getting error messages, but the system reports normal function.
Switch to the redundant system.
I'm doing that, but... Wait, now the hub's getting... Oh, shit.
What? Came Needleman's sharp voice. At the same time, Hatch heard the sound of the pumps on the island faltering.
System crash, said Wapner.
There was a sudden, sharp, garbled noise from Bonterre. Hatch glanced toward the video screen and saw it had gone dead. No, he corrected himself. Not dead, but black. And then snow began to creep into the blackness until the signal was lost in a howling storm of electronic distortion.
What the hell?
Streeter said, frantically punching the comm button. Bonterre, can you hear me? We've lost your feed. Bonterre! Scapati broke the surface 10 feet from the boat and tore the regulator from his mouth.
Bonterre's been sucked into the tunnel, he gasped.
What was that? Needleman cried over the radio. He said Bonterre's been sucked, Streeter began.
God damn it, go back after her,
Needleman barked, his electronic voice rasping across the water.
It's murder down there, Scapati yelled. There's a massive back current and...
Streeter, give him a lifeline, Needleman called. And Magnuson, bypass that computer control. Get the pumps started manually. Losing them must have created some kind of backflow.
Yes, sir,
said Magnuson. The team will have to reprime them by hand. I'll need at least 5 minutes minimum. Run, came Needleman's voice, hard but suddenly calm. And do it in 3.
Yes, sir.
And Wapner, get the system online.
Captain,
Wapner began. The diagnostics are telling me that everything's...
Stop talking, snapped Needleman. Start fixing.
Scapati clipped a lifeline around his belt and disappeared again over the side. I'm clearing this area, Hatch said to Streeter as he began to spread towels over the deck to receive his potential patient. Streeter played the lifeline out, helped by Rankin. There was a sudden tug, then steady tension.
Streeter, came Needleman's voice.
Scapati's in the backflow, said Streeter. I can feel him on the line. Hatch stared at the snow on the screen with a macabre sense of deja vu. It was as if she had disappeared, vanished, just as suddenly as... He took a deep breath and looked away. There was nothing he could do until they got her to the surface. Nothing. Suddenly there was a noise from the island as the pumps roared into life.
Good work, came Needleman's voice from the comm set.
Line's gone slack, said Streeter. There was a tense silence. Hatch could see the last bits of dye boiling off as the flow came back out the tunnel. And suddenly the video screen went black again, and then he heard gasping over the audio line. The black on the screen grew lighter until, with a flood of relief, he saw a green square of light growing across the screen. The exit to the flood tunnel.
Merde,
came Bonterre's voice as she was ejected from the opening, the view from the camera tumbling wildly. Moments later, there was a swirl at the surface. Hatch and Rankin rushed to the side of the boat and lifted Bonterre aboard. Scapati followed, stripping off her tanks and hood as Hatch laid her down on the towels. Opening her mouth, Hatch checked the airway. All clear. He unzipped her wetsuit at the chest and placed a stethoscope. She was breathing well, no sound of water in the lungs, and her heartbeat was fast and strong. He noticed a gash in the suit along her stomach, skin and a ribbon of blood swelling along its edge.
Incroyable,
Bonterre coughed, trying to sit up, waving a chip of something gray.
Keep still,
Hatch said sharply.
Cement,
she cried, clutching the chip.
300-year-old cement. There was a row of stones set into the reef.
Hatch felt quickly around the base of her skull, looking for evidence of a concussion or spinal injury. There were no swellings, cuts, dislocations.
C'est suffit,
she said, turning her head.
What are you, a phrenologist?
Streeter, report, Needleman barked over the radio. They're aboard, sir, Streeter said. Bonterre seems to be fine.
I am fine, except for these meddlesome doctor,
she cried, struggling. Just a moment while I look at your stomach, Hatch said, gently restraining her.
Those stones, they look like the foundation to something,
she continued, lying back.
Sergio, did you see that? What could it be?
With a single movement, Hatch unzipped the wetsuit down to her navel.
"Hey!"
cried Bonterre. Ignoring the outcry, Hatch quickly explored the cut. There was a nasty scrape below her ribs, but it seemed superficial along its entire length.
"It is just a scratch,"
protested Bonterre, craning her neck to see what Hatch was doing. He snatched his hand from her belly as a distinctly unprofessional stirring coursed through his loins. "Perhaps you're right," he said a little more sarcastically than he intended, fishing in his bag for a topical antibiotic ointment. "Next time let me play in the water and you can be the doctor. Meanwhile, I'm going to apply some of this anyway, in case of infection." "You had a close call." He rubbed ointment into the scrape.
"That tickles,"
said Bonterre. Scapati had stripped off his suit to the waist and stood with his arms crossed, his tanned physique gleaming in the sun, grinning fondly. Rankin stood next to him, her suit and massive, watching Bonterre with a distinct gleam in his eyes.
"Everyone," thought Malin, "is in love with this woman." "I ended up in a big underwater cavern," she was saying. "For a moment, I couldn't find the walls, and I thought that was the end. Fan."
"A cavern?" Needleman asked doubtfully over the open channel.
"Mais oui, a big cavern. But my radio was dead. Why would that be?"
"The tunnel must have blocked the transmission," Needleman said.
"But why the back current?" Bonterre said. "The tide was going out."
There was a brief silence. "I don't have an answer to that," Needleman's voice came at last. "Perhaps once we've drained the pit and its tunnels, we'll learn why. I'll be waiting for a full report. Meanwhile, why don't you rest? Grampus out." Streeter turned. "Markers set. Returning to base." The boat rumbled to life and planed across the water, riding the gentle swells. Hatch stowed his gear, listening to the chatter on the radio bands. Needleman, on the Grampus, was talking to Island One.
"I'm telling you, we've got a cybergeist," came the voice of Wapner. "I just did a ROM dump on Charybdis and ran it against Scylla. Everything's messed up 9 ways to Sunday." "But that's burned in code, Captain. The goddamn system's cursed. Not even a hacker could rewrite ROM."
"Don't start talking about curses," said Needleman sharply. As they approached the dock, Bonterre peeled off her wetsuit, packed it into a deck locker, wrung out her hair, and turned toward Hatch.
"Well, Doctor, my nightmare came true. I did need your services after all."
"It was nothing," said Hatch, blushing and furiously aware of it.
"Oh, but it was very nice."
Chapter 16. The stone ruins of Fort Blacklock stood in a meadow looking down on the entrance to Stormhaven Harbor. The circular fort was surrounded by a large meadow dotted with white pines, which fell away to farmers' fields and a sugar bush, a thick stand of sugar maples. Across the meadow from the old fort, a large yellow and white pavilion had been erected, decorated with ribbons and pennants that fluttered merrily in the breeze. A banner over the pavilion proclaimed in hand-painted letters, 71st Annual Stormhaven Lobster Bake. Hatch headed apprehensively up the gentle slope of the grassy hill. The lobster bake was the first real opportunity for him to meet the town at large, and he wasn't at all sure what kind of reception to expect. But there was little doubt in his mind about what kind of reception the expedition itself would receive. Although Thalassa had been in Stormhaven little more than a week, the company's impact had been considerable. Crew members had taken most of the available rental houses and spare rooms, sometimes paying premium prices. They had filled the tiny bed and breakfast. The 2 restaurants in town, Anchors Away and The Landing, were packed every night. The gas station at the wharf had been forced to triple its deliveries, and business at the Superette, though Bud would never admit to it, was up at least 50%. The town was in such a fine mood about the Ragged Island treasure hunt that the mayor had hastily made the Lassa the collective guest of honor at the lobster bake. And Needleman's quietly picking up half the tab, at Hatch's suggestion,
had simply been icing on the cake. As he approached the pavilion, Hatch could make out the table of honor, already occupied by prominent town citizens and the Lhasa officials. A small podium and microphone had been placed behind it. Beyond, townspeople and expedition members were milling around, drinking lemonade or beer, and lining up to get their lobsters. As he ducked inside, he heard a familiar nasal shout. Carrie Wapner was carrying a paper plate, groaning under the weight of twin lobsters, potato salad, and corn on the cob. A huge draft beer was balanced in his other hand. The cryptanalyst walked gingerly along, arms straight ahead, trying to keep the food and beer from dripping on his trademark Hawaiian shirt, Bermuda shorts, high white socks, and black sneakers.
"How do you eat these things?"
Wapner cried, buttonholing a confused lobster man.
"What's that?"
the lobster man said, inclining his head as if he hadn't heard properly.
"We didn't have lobsters where I grew up."
"No lobsters?" the man said, as if considering this.
"Yeah. In Brooklyn. It's part of America. You should visit the country sometime. Anyway, I never learned how to eat one."
Wapner's loud drawl echoed up and down the pavilion.
"I mean, how do you open the shells?"
With a stolid face, the lobster man replied,
"You sit on 'em real hard."
There was a guffaw of laughter from nearby townspeople.
"Very funny," said Wapner.
"Well, now," the lobster man said in a gentler tone, "you need crackers."
"I got crackers,"
Wapner replied eagerly, waving the plate heaped with oyster crackers under the man's nose. There was another round of laughter from the locals.
"Crackers to crack the shells, see?" the lobster man said. "Or you can use a hammer."
He held up a boat hammer, covered with lobster juice, tamale, and bits of pink shell.
"Eat with a dirty hammer?" Wapner cried. "Hepatitis City, here we come."
Hatch moved in. "I'll give him a hand," he said to the lobster man, who went off shaking his head. Hatch ushered Wapner to one of the tables, sat him down, and gave him a quick lesson in lobster consumption. How to crack open the shells, what to eat, what not to eat. Then he went off to get some food himself, stopping along the way to fill a pint cup at an enormous keg. The beer, from a small brewery in Camden, was cold and malty. He gulped it down, feeling the tightness in his chest unraveling, and refilled the cup before getting in line. The lobsters and corn had been steamed in piles of seaweed heaped over burning oak, sending clouds of fragrant smoke spiraling into the blue sky. Three cooks were busily at work behind the mounds of seaweed, checking the fires, dumping bright red lobsters onto paper plates.
"Dr. Hatch," came a voice.
Hatch turned to see Doris Bowditch, another splendid muumuu billowing behind her like a purple parachute. Her husband stood to one side, small, razor-burned, and silent.
"How did you find the house?"
"Wonderful," said Hatch with genuine warmth. "Thanks for tuning the piano."
"You're certainly welcome. No problems with the power or the water, I expect?"
"Good.
You know, I wondered if you'd had a chance to think about that nice couple from Manchester?"
"Yes," said Hatch quickly, ready now. "I won't be selling."
"Oh," said Doris, her face falling. "They were so counting on—"
"Yes, but Doris, it's the house I grew up in," Hatch said, gently but firmly. The woman gave a start, as if remembering the circumstances of Hatch's childhood and departure from the town.
"Of course," she said,
with an attempt at a smile, laying her hand on his arm.
"I understand. It's hard to give up the family home. We'll say no more about it."
She gave his arm a squeeze.
"For now."
Hatch reached the front of the line and turned his attention to the enormous steaming piles of seaweed. The nearest cook flipped over one of the piles, exposing a row of red lobsters, some ears of corn, and a scattering of eggs. He picked up an egg with a mitted hand, chopped it in half with a knife, and peered inside to see if it was hard. That, Hatch remembered, was how they judged when the lobsters were cooked.
"Perfecto," the cook said.
The voice was distantly familiar, and Hatch suddenly recognized his old high school classmate, Donnie Truitt. He braced himself.
"Why, if it ain't Mally Hatch," said Truitt, recognizing him. "I was wondering when I'd run into you. Damn it to hell, how are you?"
"Donnie," Hatch cried, grasping his hand. "I'm not bad. You?"
"The same. Four kids. Looking for a new job since Martin's Marine went under."
"Four kids?" Hatch whistled. "You've been busy."
"Busier than you think.
Divorced twice, too."
"What the hell? You hitched?"
"Not yet," Hatch said. Donnie smirked. "Seen Claire yet?" "No." Hatch felt a sudden swell of irritation. As Donnie slipped a lobster onto his plate, Hatch looked at his old classmate. He'd grown paunchy, a little slow, but otherwise they'd picked up right where they left off 25 years before. The talkative kid with few brains but a big heart had obviously grown up into the adult equivalent. Donnie gave Hatch a suggestive leer. "Come on, Donnie," Hatch said. "Claire and I were just friends."
"Oh, yeah. Friends.
I don't think friends were caught kissing in Squeaker's Glen. It was just kissing, Mal.
Wasn't it?"
"That was a long time ago. I don't remember every detail of my every romance."
"Nothing like first love, though, eh, Mal?"
Donnie chuckled, one goggle eye winking below the mop of carrot-colored hair.
"She's around here somewhere. Anyway, you'll have to look elsewhere, 'cause she ended up..."
Suddenly, Hatch had heard enough about Claire. "I'm holding up the line," he interrupted.
"You sure are. I'll see you later."
Donnie waved his fork with another grin, expertly flipping open more layers of seaweed to expose another row of gleaming red lobsters. "So Donnie needs a job," Hatch thought as he headed back toward the table of honor. "Wouldn't hurt for Thalassa to hire a few locals." He found a seat at the table between Bill Banns, the editor of the paper, and Bud Rowell. Captain Needleman was two seats down, next to Mayor Jasper Fitzgerald and the local congregational minister, Woody Clay. On the far side of Clay sat Lyle Streeter. Hatch looked at the two locals curiously. Jasper Fitzgerald's father had run the local funeral home, and no doubt the son had inherited it. Fitzgerald was in his early 50s, a florid man with handlebar mustaches, alligator clip suspenders, and a baritone voice that carried like a contrabassoon. Hatch's eyes traveled to Woody Clay. "He's obviously an outsider," he thought. Clay was, in almost every way, the opposite of Fitzgerald. He had the spare frame of an ascetic, coupled with the hollow, spiritual face of a saint just in from the desert. But there was also a crabbed, narrow intensity to his gaze. Hatch could see he was ill at ease being part of the table of honor. He was one of those people who spoke to you in a low voice, as if he didn't want anyone else to overhear, evident from his low-pitched conversation with Streeter. Hatch wondered what the minister was saying that was making the team leader look so uncomfortable. "Seen the paper, Malin?" Bill Banns interrupted Hatch's thoughts with his characteristic lazy drawl. As a young man, Banns had seen the front page at the local cinema. Ever since, his views of what a newsman should look like had never altered. His sleeves were always rolled, even on the coldest day, and he'd worn a green visor so long that today his forehead seemed lonely without it.
"No, I haven't," Hatch replied. "I didn't know it was out."
"Just this morning," Banns answered. "Yep. Think you'll like it. Wrote the lead article myself. With your help, of course." He touched a finger to his nose, as if to say, "You keep me in the pipeline, and I'll keep the good words flowing." Hatch made a mental note to stop by the Superette that evening for a copy. Various instruments for lobster dissection lay on the table. Hammers, crackers, and wooden mallets, all slick with lobster gore. Two great bowls in the center were heaped with broken shells and split carapaces. Everyone was pounding, cracking, and eating. Glancing around the pavilion, Hatch could see that Wapner had somehow ended up at the table with the workers from the local lobsterman's co-op. He could just catch Wapner's abrasive voice drifting on the wind. "Did you know," the cryptanalyst was saying, "that biologically speaking, lobsters are basically insects? When you really get down to it, they're big red underwater cockroaches." Hatch turned away and took another generous pull on his beer. This was turning out to be bearable after all. Perhaps more than bearable. He was sure that everyone in town knew his story, word for word. Yet, perhaps out of politeness, perhaps out of pure rural bashfulness, not a word had been said. For that, he was grateful. He looked across the crowd, scanning for familiar faces. He saw Christopher St. John, sandwiched at a table between two overweight locals, apparently contemplating how to dismantle his lobster while making the least degree of mess. Hatch's eyes roved farther, and he picked out Kai Estenson, proprietor of the hardware store, and Tyra Thompson, commandant of the free library, not looking a day older than when she used to shoo him and Johnny out of the building for telling jokes and giggling too loudly. "Guess it's true what they say about vinegar being a preservative," he thought. Then, in a flash of recognition, he saw the white head and stooped shoulders of Dr. Horn, his old biology teacher, standing on the outskirts of the pavilion as if not deigning to soil his hands with lobster ruin. Dr. Horn, who'd graded him more toughly than any graduate school professor ever did, who told him he'd seen roadkill that was better dissected than the frogs Hatch worked on. The intimidating, yet fiercely supportive Dr. Horn, who more than any other person had fired Hatch's interest in science and medicine. Hatch was surprised and relieved to see him still among the living. Looking away, Hatch turned toward Bud, who was sucking lobster meat out of a leg. "Tell me about Woody Clay," Hatch said. Bud tossed the leg into the nearest bowl. "Reverend Clay? He's the minister. Used to be a hippie, I hear." "Where'd he come from?" asked Hatch. "Somewhere down around Boston. Came up here 20 years ago to do some preaching. Decided to stay. They say he gave away a big inheritance when he took the cloth." Bud sliced open the tail with an expert hand and extracted it in one piece. There was a hesitant note in his voice that puzzled Hatch. "Why'd he stay?" Hatch asked.
"Oh, liked the place, probably. You know how it goes."
Bud fell silent as he polished off the tail. Hatch glanced over at Clay, who was no longer talking to Streeter. As he examined the intense face curiously, the man suddenly looked up and met his gaze. Hatch looked away awkwardly, turning back toward Bud Roll, only to find that the grocer had gone off in search of more lobster. Out of the corner of his eye, he could see the minister rise from the table and approach. "Malin Hatch," the man said, extending his hand. "I'm Reverend Clay."
"Nice to meet you, Reverend."
Hatch stood up and took the cold, tentative hand. Clay hesitated a moment, then gestured at the empty chair.
"May I?"
"If Bud doesn't mind, I don't," Hatch said. The minister awkwardly eased his angular frame into the small chair, his bony knees sticking up almost to the level of the table, and turned a pair of large, intense eyes on Hatch.
"I've seen all the activity out at Ragged Island," he began in a low voice. "I've heard it, too. Banging and clanging. By night as well as by day."
"Guess we're a little like the post office," Hatch said, trying to sound light-hearted, uncertain of where this was heading. "We never sleep." If Clay was amused, he didn't show it.
"This operation must be costing somebody a good deal," he said, raising his eyebrows to make it a question.
"We've got investors," Hatch said.
"Investors," Clay repeated.
"That's when somebody gives you $10 and hopes you'll give back 20.
"You could put it that way."
Clay nodded.
"My father loved money, too. Not that it made him a happier man.
or prolonged his life by even an hour. When he died, I inherited his stocks and bonds. The accountant called it a portfolio. When I got to looking into it, I found tobacco companies, mining companies tearing down whole mountains, timber companies that were clear-cutting virgin forests. As he spoke, his eyes never strayed from Hatch's. "I see," Hatch said at last. "Here my father had given money to these people, hoping they'd give back twice as much. And that's just what had happened. They'd given back 2, 3, or 4 times more. And now all these immoral gains were mine." Hatch nodded. Clay lowered his head and his voice. "May I ask, how much wealth, exactly, you and your investors hope to gain from all this?" Something in the way the minister pronounced wealth made Hatch more wary, but to refuse to answer the question would be a mistake. "Let's just say it's well into 7 figures, he replied. Clay nodded slowly. "I'm a direct man, he began, and I'm not good at small talk. I never learned how to say things gracefully, so I just say them the best way I can. I don't like this treasure hunt." "I'm sorry to hear that," Hatch replied. Clay blinked back at him intently. "I don't like all these people coming into our town and throwing their money around." From the beginning, Hatch had steeled himself against the possibility of such a response. Now that he was hearing it at last, he felt strangely relaxed. "I'm not sure that the other townspeople share your disdain of money," he said evenly. "Many of these people have been poor all their lives. They didn't have the luxury of choosing poverty as you did." Clay's face tightened, and Hatch could see he'd hit a nerve. "Money isn't the panacea people think it is," the minister continued. "You know that as well as I. These people have their dignity. Money will ruin this town. It'll spoil the lobstering, spoil the tranquility, spoil everything. And the poorest people won't see any of that money anyway. They'll be pushed out by development, by progress." Hatch did not reply. On one level, he understood what Clay was saying. It would be a tragedy if Stormhaven turned into another overdeveloped, overpriced summer playground like Booth Bay Harbor down the coast. But that didn't seem likely, whether or not the Lasses succeeded. "There's not much I can say," Hatch said. "The operation will be over in a matter of weeks." "How long it takes isn't the point," Clay said, a strident note entering his voice. "The point is the motivation behind it. This treasure hunt is about greed. Pure, naked greed. Already, a man lost his legs. No good will come of this. That island is a bad place. Cursed, if you care to call it that. I'm not superstitious, but God has a way of punishing those with impure motives." Hatch's feeling of calm suddenly dissolved in a flood of anger. "Our town. Impure motives. If you'd grown up in this town, you'd know why I'm doing this," he snapped. "Don't presume to know what my motives are."
"I don't presume anything," Clay said, his lanky body stiffening like a spring. "I know. I may not have grown up in this town, but I at least know what's in its best interests. Everyone here's been seduced by this treasure hunt, by the promise of easy money. But not me, by the Lord God, not me. I'm going to protect this town. Protect it from you and from itself." "Reverend Clay, I think you should read your Bible before you start throwing around accusations like that. Judge not, that ye be not judged."
Hatch realized he was shouting, voice shaking with anger. The surrounding tables had fallen silent, the people staring down at their plates. Abruptly he rose, strode past the silent, white-faced Clay, and made for the dark ruins of the fort across the meadow. Chapter 17. The fort was dark and chill with damp. Swallows flitted about the interior of the granite tower, whipping back and forth like bullets in the sunlight that angled sharply through the ancient gun ports. Hatch entered through the stone archway and paused, breathing heavily, trying to recover his composure. Despite himself, he'd allowed the minister to provoke him. Half the town had seen it, and the half that hadn't would soon know about it. He took a seat on an outcropping of the stone foundation. No doubt Clay had been talking to others. Hatch doubted most people would listen, except perhaps the lobstermen. They could be a superstitious lot, and talk about curses might weigh heavily. And then that remark about the dig ruining the lobstering. Hatch just hoped it was going to be a good season. Slowly he calmed down, letting the peace of the fort wash away his anger, listening to the faint clamor of the festival across the meadow. He really had to control himself better. The man was an obnoxious prig, but he wasn't worth flying off the handle of her. It was a tranquil, womb-like space, and Hatch felt he could stay there, enjoying the coolness for hours. But he knew he should be returning to the festival, putting up a nonchalant front, smoothing things over. In any case, he needed to be back before the inevitable speeches began. He stood up and turned to go, and saw with surprise a stooped figure waiting in the shadows of the archway. It stepped forward into a shaft of light. "Professor Horn!" Hatch cried. The man's canny old face crinkled with delight. "I wondered when you'd notice me," he said, advancing with his cane. He shook Hatch's hand warmly. "That was quite a little scene back there." Hatch shook his head. "I lost my temper, like an idiot. What is it about that man that gets my goat?" "No mystery there. Clay is awkward, socially inept, morally rigid. But beneath that bitter exterior there beats a heart as big and generous as the ocean. As violent and unknowable, too, I'll bet. He's a complex man, Manon. Don't underestimate him." The professor grasped Hatch's shoulder. "Enough about the reverend. By God, Mallon, you're looking well. I'm prodigiously proud of you. Harvard Medical School, research position at Mount Auburn. You were always a smart boy. Too bad it didn't always equate to being a good student." "I owe a lot of it to you," Hatch said. He remembered afternoons in the professor's huge Victorian house in the back meadows, poring over his collections of rocks, beetles, and butterflies, in those last years before leaving Stormhaven.
"Nonsense. I still have your bird nest collection, by the way. Never knew where to send it after you left."
Hatch felt a twinge of guilt. It had never occurred to him that the august professor would have wanted to hear from him. "I'm surprised you didn't throw that junk away."
"Actually, it was a remarkably good collection."
He shifted his hand to Hatch's arm and held it in a bony clasp.
"See me out the fort and across the meadow, would you? I'm a little shaky on my wheels these days."
"I would have gotten in touch." Hatch's voice trailed away.
"Not a word. Not even a forwarding address," the professor said acidly. "Then I read about you in the Globe last year."
Hatch turned away, feeling shame burning his face. The professor gave a gruff snort.
"No matter. According to the actuarial tables, I should be dead. I'll be 89 next Thursday. And damn you if you don't bring me a present."
They emerged into the sunlight of the meadow. Voices raised in laughter drifted toward them on the breeze.
"You must have heard why I came back," Hatch said tentatively.
"Who hasn't?" was the tart reply.
The professor offered nothing further, and they walked on in silence for a moment.
"So?" Hatch said at last.
The old man looked at him inquiringly.
"So drop the other shoe," Hatch continued. "What do you think of this treasure hunt?"
The professor walked on for a minute, then stopped and turned toward Mallon, lowering his arm as he did so.
"Remember, you asked," he said.
Hatch nodded.
"I think you're a goddamn fool."
There was a moment of stunned surprise. He'd been prepared for Clay, but not for this.
"What makes you say that?"
"You, of all the people on this earth, should know better. Whatever's down there, you won't get it out."
"Look, Dr. Horn, we've got technology those old treasure hunters never even dreamed of. Hard-body sonar, proton magnetometers, a photo-reconnaissance satellite downlink. We've got $20 million in funding, and we even have the private journal of the man who designed the pit."
Hatch's voice had risen. He suddenly realized that it was very important for him to have this man's good opinion. Dr. Horn shook his head.
"Mallon, for almost a century I've seen them come and go. Everyone had the latest equipment. Everyone had gobs of money. Everyone had some crucial piece of information, some brilliant insight. It was always going to be different. And they all ended up the same. Bankruptcy. Misery. Even death."
He glanced at Hatch.
"Have you found any treasure yet?"
"Well, not yet," Hatch said. "There's been one small problem. We knew that the pit must have an underground flood tunnel leading to the sea. That's why it's always filled with water. We used dye to locate the flood tunnel's exit on the sea floor. Only, it seems there's not one flood tunnel, but five, and..."
"I see," Dr. Horn interrupted. "Just one small problem. I've heard that before, too. Maybe you'll solve your problem. Only then there will be another problem, and another, until you're all bankrupt, or dead, or both."
"But this will be different," Hatch cried. "You can't tell me it's impossible to raise the treasure. What man created, man can defeat." The professor suddenly gripped Hatch's arm again. He had alarmingly strong hands, corded like ancient tree roots, sinewy and dry.
"I knew your grandfather, Mallon. He was a lot like you. Young, smart as hell, promising career ahead of him, terrific enthusiasm for life. What you just said is exactly what he said to me, word for word, 50 years ago.
He lowered his voice to a fierce whisper.
"Look at the legacy he left your family. You asked my opinion, so here it is in a nutshell. Go back to Boston, before history repeats itself."
He turned brusquely and hobbled off, his cane flicking irritably through the grass, until he had disappeared over the brow of the hill. Chapter 18. The next morning, a little bleary-eyed from the beer of the previous day, Hatch closeted himself in the medical hut, laying out instruments and taking inventory. There had been a number of injuries over the last several days, but nothing more serious than a few scrapes and a cracked rib. As he moved through his shelves, checking against a printed master list, he could hear the monotonous hiss of surf from the nearby reefs. The sun struggled wanly through the metal-sided window, attenuated by the omnipresent curtain of mist. Finishing the inventory, Hatch hung his clipboard beside the shelves and glanced out the window. He could see the tall, slope-shouldered form of Christopher St. John walking gingerly over the rough ground of base camp. The Englishman dodged a heavy cable and a length of PVC pipe, then ducked into Wapner's quarters, his unruly gray hair barely clearing the doorframe. Hatch stood for a moment, then picked up the two black binders and exited the medical office, following the historian. Maybe there was some progress to report on the code. Wapner's base camp office was, if anything, even more messy than his stateroom on the Cerberus. Small to begin with, banks of monitoring and servo control equipment made it claustrophobic. Wapner occupied the office's lone chair, crammed into a far corner by the relay racks that surrounded him. Cold air was blasting from two ducts overhead, and a massive air conditioner grumbled on the far side of the wall. Despite the air conditioning, the room was stuffy with hot electronics, and as Hatch walked in, St. John was looking for a place to hang his jacket. His search unsuccessful, he laid it carefully on a nearby console.
"Jeez," said Wapner. "You lay your hairy old tweed there, and it's going to short-circuit the whole works."
Frowning, St. John picked it up again.
"Kerry, do you have a minute?" he said. "We really need to discuss this problem with the code."
"Do I look like I have a minute?"
came the response. Wapner leaned away from his terminal with a glare.
"I've just now finished an all-island diagnostic. The whole ball of wax, right down to the microcode. Took an hour, even at maximum bandwidth. Everything checks out. Pumps, compressors, servos, you name it. No problems or discrepancies of any kind."
"That's great," Hatch broke in. Wapner looked at him incredulously.
"Grow a brain, will you? Great? It's friggin' terrible."
"I don't understand."
"We had a system crash, remember? The goddamn pumps went south on us. Afterward, I compared the island computer system with Scylla over on the Cerberus, and guess what? The ROM chips on Charybdis here had been altered."
"Altered!" He angrily smacked one of the CPUs upside its cabinet.
"And?" "But now I run the diagnostics again and everything's fine. Not only that, but the entire grid shows no deviations of any kind."
Wapner leaned forward.
"No deviations. Don't you get it? That's a physical and computational impossibility."
St. John was glancing at the equipment around him, hands tucked behind his back.
"Ghost in the machine, Kerry?"
he ventured. Wapner ignored this.
"I don't know much about computers,"
St. John continued, his plummy accent filling the air.
"But I do know one term. G-I-G-O. Garbage in, garbage out."
"Bite me. It's not the programming."
"Ah, I see. Couldn't possibly be human error. As I recall, all it took was one incorrect Fortran equation to send Mariner 1 off on some outer space scavenger hunt, never to be heard from again."
"The point is, things are working now," Hatch said. "So why not move on?"
"Sure, and have it happen again. I want to know why all this shit failed at once."
"You can't do anything about it now," St. John said. "Meanwhile, we're falling behind schedule on the cryptanalysis. Nothing's worked. I've done some more research, and I think we've been far too quick to dismiss..."
"Shit on a stick!" Wapner snapped, wheeling toward him. "You're not going to start mumbling about polyalphabetics again, are you, old thing? Look, I'm going to modify the algorithm of my brute force attack, give it 50% system priority, really get things moving. Why don't you retire to your library? Come back at the end of the day with some useful ideas."
St. John looked briefly at Wapner. Then he shrugged into his tweed and ducked back out into the gauzy morning light. Hatch followed him to his own office. "Thanks," Hatch said, passing the two folders to St. John.
"He's right, you know,"
the historian said, taking a seat at his tidy desk and wearily pulling the old typewriter toward him.
"It's just that I've tried everything else. I've based my attacks on all the encryption methods known during McCallan's time. I've approached it as an arithmetic problem, as an astronomic or astrologic system, as a foreign language code. Nothing What are polyalphabetics? Hatch asked. St. John sighed.
A polyalphabetic cipher. It's quite simple, really.
You see, most codes in Macallan's day were simple, monophonic substitutions. You had the regular alphabet, then you had a cipher alphabet, all higgledy-piggledy. To encode something, you simply looked up which cipher letter matched the next regular letter in your document. Maybe the code for S was Y, and the code for E was Z. So when you coded the word C, you'd get Y, Z, Z. That's how the cryptograms in your local newspaper work.
Seems clear enough.
Yes, but it's not a very secure system. So what if you had several different cipher alphabets to work with? Let's say instead of just one, you had 10. And as you encrypted your document letter by letter, you'd move through all 10 cipher alphabets, and then start over again with the first. That's a polyalphabetic cipher. Now, C wouldn't just be Y, Z, Z. Each letter would be coded from a different cipher table.
Sounds difficult to crack.
Yes, they are very difficult. But Carey's point is that polyalphabetics weren't used in Macallan's day. Oh, people knew about them, but they were considered too time-consuming, too prone to error.
St. John sighed again.
But in this case, the biggest problem is one of concealment. If Macallan used a polyalphabetic cipher, how could he have safely hidden all the code alphabet tables he would have needed? Just one chance look at those by Red Ned Occam would give the whole game away. And as bright as he was, he couldn't have memorized them.
If you think there's the chance it's a polyalphabetic code, why don't you try cracking it on your own?
The corners of St. John's lips lifted in what might have been a smile. If I had 2 months, I'd be happy to give it a try. But I don't. Besides, I have no idea how long a key he was using, if any, or how liberally he'd strewn his nulls.
Nulls?
Nihil importantes. Letters that don't stand for anything, but are tossed in to confuse the codebreaker.
A boat horn sounded outside, deep and mysterious, and Hatch checked his watch.
It's 10, he said.
I'd better go. They'll be sealing the flood tunnels and draining the water pit in a few minutes. Good luck with Carey.
Chapter 19. Leaving base camp, Hatch began jogging up the path toward Orthanc, eager to see the new structure that had materialized over the water pit in just 48 hours. Even before he reached the crest of the island, he could make out the glassed-in observation tower, a narrow deck running around its outer edge. As he drew closer, he could see the massive supports that suspended the derrick almost 40 feet above the sandy ground. Winches and cables dangled from the underside of the tower, reaching down into the darkness of the pit.
My God, Hatch thought. They must be able to see this thing from the mainland.
With this, his thoughts drifted back to the lobster festival, and to what Clay and his old teacher had said. He knew that Professor Horn would keep his opinions to himself. Clay, though, was another matter. So far, public sentiment toward the Lassa seemed overwhelmingly favorable. He'd have to be careful to keep it that way. Even before the festival had come to a close, he'd spoken to Needleman about giving Donnie Truitt a job. The captain had promptly added him to the excavation crew that would start digging at the bottom of the water pit as soon as it was drained. Hatch approached the derrick and climbed the external ladder. The view from the observation deck was magnificent. The ever-present mist was breaking into tatters under the hot summer sun, and he could just make out the dark purple stripe of the mainland. The sun glinted off the ocean, turning it the color of beaten metal, and the surf broke over the windward reefs, surrounding them with spume and a line of drifting wrack. A phrase from Rupert Brooke surfaced unbidden in his mind.
the little dulling edge of foam that browns and dwindles as the wave goes home. He raised his head at the sound of voices. On the far side of the observation deck he could see Isabelle Bonterre, her wetsuit shining damply in the sun. She was leaning over the railing, twisting the excess water out of her hair and talking animatedly to Needleman. As Hatch strolled over, she turned to him with a grin.
"Well, well, the man who saved my life."
"How's your wound?" Hatch replied.
"De rien, monsieur le docteur. I was out diving this morning at 6, no doubt while you were still snoring the loud snores. And you will not believe what I have discovered."
Hatch glanced at Needleman, who was nodding and puffing on his pipe, clearly pleased.
"That stone foundation I found on the seabed the other day," she continued. "It runs along the inside wall of the reefs, all around the southern end of the island. I traced the remains this morning. There is only one explanation for it. The foundation to an ancient cofferdam."
"An ancient cofferdam? Built around the end of the island? But why?" Even as Hatch asked the question, he realized the answer.
"Jesus," he exhaled. Bonterre grinned. "The pirates built a semicircular dam all along the southern reefs. They sunk wooden pilings, arcing out from the shore into the shallow water, then coming back to land again, like a stockade fence in the sea. I found tracings of pitch and oakum, which they probably used to make the pilings watertight. Then they pumped out the seawater, exposed the seafloor around the beach, and excavated the 5 flood tunnels. When they were done, they simply destroyed the cofferdam and let the water back in. Et voila, the traps were set."
"Yes," Needleman added. "Almost obvious when you think of it. How else could they build underwater flood tunnels without the benefit of scuba gear? McAllen was an engineer as well as an architect. He advised on the construction of Old Battersea Bridge, so he knew about shallow water construction. He undoubtedly planned all of this, down to the last detail."
"A cofferdam around the entire end of the island?" Hatch said. "Sounds like a huge task."
"Huge, yes. But remember, he had over 1,000 enthusiastic laborers to do it. And they had enormous chain pumps from the bilges of their ships." There was another blast from a boat horn, and Needleman checked his watch. 15 minutes until we blow the explosives and seal those 5 flood tunnels. The mist is clearing nicely. We should have a fine view. Come on inside." The captain ushered them inside Orthanc. Beneath the windows that lined the walls of the tower, Hatch could see banks of equipment and horizontally mounted monitors. Magnuson and Rankin, the geologist, stood at stations in opposite corners of the tower, while a couple of technicians Hatch didn't recognize were busy wiring and testing components. Against one wall, a series of screens showed closed-circuit video feeds from around the island. The command center, the mouth of the pit, the interior of Orthanc itself. The most remarkable feature of the tower was a massive glass plate that occupied the center of the floor. Hatch stepped forward and gazed down into the maw of the water pit. "Watch this," Needleman said, flicking a switch on a nearby console. A powerful mercury arc lamp snapped on, its beams stabbing down into the darkness. Below, the pit was drowned in seawater. Bits of seaweed floated in the water and brine shrimp, attracted by the light, jerked and played just below the surface. A few feet into the murky water, he could make out stumps of old timbers, heavy with barnacles, their ragged lengths disappearing into the depths. The fat, metal-jointed pump hose ran along the ground and over the side of the pit, joining 6 other, narrower cables and feeder lines. "The throat of the beast," Needleman said with grim satisfaction. He swept his hand over the consoles ranged beneath the windows. "We've equipped the tower with the latest remote sensing equipment, including L-band and X-band synthetic aperture downward-pointing radar. all with dedicated links to the base camp computer. He checked his watch again. Dr. Magnuson, is the comm station in order?
Yes, Captain, the engineer said, brushing her short hair back. All five marker buoys are transmitting clearly, ready for your arming signal.
Is Wapner in Island One?
I beeped him about 5 minutes ago. He should be there shortly if he isn't already.
Needleman strode toward a bank of controls and snapped the radio to life. Naiad and Grampus, this is Orthanc. Do you read?
The boats acknowledged.
Take your stations. We blow the charges in 10 minutes. Hatch moved to the window. The mist had retreated to a distant haze, and he could see the two launches power away from the pier and take up positions offshore. Ringing the inside of the reef along the southern end of the island, he could make out the five electronic buoys that marked the flood tunnel exits. Each flood tunnel, he knew, had now been mined with several pounds of Semtex. The buoy antennas winked in the light, ready to receive the detonation signals.
Island One report, Needleman spoke into the radio.
Wapner here.
Are the monitoring systems online?
Yes. Everything's hunky-dory.
Wapner sounded dejected. Good. Advise me of any changes.
Captain, why am I here? The voice complained. The tower's fully networked, and you're going to be running the pumps manually. Anything you need to do, you can do there. I should be working on that damn code.
I don't want any more surprises, Needleman replied. We'll set off the charges, seal the flood tunnels, then pump the water out of the pit. You should be curled up with that journal again in no time. There was a flurry of activity below, and Hatch could see Streeter directing a team into position around the pump hose. Bonterre came back in from the deck, her hair streaming behind her.
How long until the fireworks start? She asked.
5 minutes, said Needleman.
How exciting. I love a big explosion.
She looked at Hatch with a wink.
Dr. Magnuson, Needleman said. A final check, if you please.
Certainly, Captain.
There was a brief silence.
Everything's green. Comm signals are good. Pumps primed and idling.
Rankin gestured Hatch over and pointed toward a screen.
Check it out.
The screen showed a cross-section of the pit, marked in 10-foot intervals down to 100 feet. A blue column sat inside the cross-section, level with the surface.
We were able to snake a miniature depth meter into the pit, he said excitedly.
Streeter sent a dive team down earlier, but they couldn't get farther than 30 feet because of all the debris clogging the works.
You wouldn't believe how much junk is collected down there.
He nodded at the screen.
With this, we'll be able to monitor the water level drop from here.
All stations listen up, Needleman said. We'll blow in series.
A silence fell in the observation tower.
Arming 1 through 5,
Magnuson said quietly, her stubby fingers moving across a console. 10 seconds, Needleman murmured. The atmosphere deepened.
Fire 1.
Hatch looked seaward. For a pregnant moment, all seemed still. Then an enormous geyser ripped out of the ocean, shot from within by orange light. A second later, the shock wave shivered the windows of the observation deck. The sound rumbled across the water, and 30 seconds later a faint answering rumble echoed back from the mainland. The geyser ascended in a strange kind of slow motion, followed by a haze of pulverized rock, mud, and seaweed. As it began falling back in a dirty plume, steep-walled waves spread out across the ocean, beating against the chop. Naiad, the nearer of the two boats, rocked crazily in the sudden swell.
Fire 2, Needleman said, and a second explosion ripped the underwater reef 100 yards from the first. One by one he detonated the underwater explosives, until it seemed to Hatch that the entire southern coast of Ragged Island had been caught in a lashing water storm.
Too bad it's not Sunday, he thought.
We'd have done Clay a favor, waking all those people asleep at his sermon. There was a brief pause while the water settled and dive teams examined the results. After receiving word that all five tunnel entrances were sealed, Needleman turned to Magnuson.
"Set the outflow valves on the pumps," he said. "Maintain a 20,000 GPM rate of flow out of the pit. Streeter, have your team stand by."
Radio in hand, he turned toward the group assembled in the tower.
"Let's drain the water pit," he said.
There was a roar on the southern shore as the pump engines came to life. Almost simultaneously, Hatch heard a great reluctant throbbing from the pit as water was sucked up from its depths. Looking down, he could see the thick hose stiffening as the water began its journey out of the pit, across the island, and back to the ocean. Rankin and Bonterre were glued to the depth display, while Magnuson was monitoring the pump subsystem. The tower began to vibrate slightly. A few minutes passed.
"Water level down 5 feet," Magnuson said.
Needleman leaned toward Hatch.
"Tidal displacement here is 8 feet," he said.
"Water never drops lower than 8 feet in the pit, even at the lowest tide. Once we reach 10 feet, we'll know we've won."
There was an endless, tense moment. Then Magnuson lifted her face from a dial.
"Water level down 10 feet, she said matter-of-factly.
The team looked at each other.
Then, suddenly, Needleman broke into a broad grin. In an instant, Orthanc's observation tower became a place of happy bedlam. Bonterre whistled loudly and jumped into the arms of a surprised Rankin. The technicians slapped each other's backs enthusiastically. Even Magnuson's lips twisted into what might have been a smile before she returned her gaze to the monitor. Amid the clapping and cheering, someone produced a bottle of Veuve Clicquot and some plastic champagne glasses.
"We did it, by God," Needleman said, shaking hands around the room.
"We're draining the water pit." He reached for the champagne, tore off the foil, and popped the cork.
"This place got its name for a reason," he said, pouring glasses. Hatch thought he could detect an emotional tremor in the captain's voice.
"For 200 years, the enemy has been the water. Until the water pit could be drained, there could be no recovery of the treasure. But, my friends, as of tomorrow, this place will need a different name. My thanks and congratulations to you all."
He raised his glass. Faint cheers resounded across the island.
"Water level down 15 feet, Magnuson said.
Holding his champagne in one hand, Hatch walked toward the center of the room and looked down into the glass.
It was unsettling, looking into the mouth of the pit. Streeter's team was standing beside the enormous hose, monitoring the flow. As the water was pumped out at a rate of 20,000 GPM, one swimming pool's worth of water every 2 minutes, Hatch thought he could actually see the surface level dropping. It crept down the seaweed-covered beams, exposing, millimeter by millimeter, the barnacle and kelp-encrusted walls. Perversely, he found himself struggling with a strange feeling of regret. It seemed anticlimactic, almost unfair, that they should accomplish in less than 2 weeks what 200 years of pain, suffering, and death had been unable to achieve.
Needleman was at the radio.
"This is the captain speaking,"
his voice echoed across the island and out over the dark water.
"I am hereby exercising my right as acting commander of this venture. All non-essential personnel may have the afternoon off."
Another cheer went up, general across the island. Hatch glanced over at Magnuson, wondering what she was studying so intently.
"Captain?"
Rankin said, staring at his own screen once again. Seeing his expression, Bonterre moved toward him, pressing her own face close to the monitor.
"Captain?"
Rankin said in a louder tone.
Needleman, in the midst of pouring more champagne, turned toward the geologist.
Rankin gestured toward the screen.
"The water's no longer dropping."
There was a silence as all eyes turned to the glass floor. A faint but continuous hissing began to rise from the pit. The dark surface of the water swirled as bubbles came streaming out of the black depths. Needleman stepped away from the glass window. "Increase the pump rate to 30, he said in a quiet voice.
"Yes, sir,"
Magnuson said. The roar from the southern end of the island grew stronger. Without a word, Hatch joined Rankin and Bonterre at the geologist's screen. The blue band of water had dropped midway between the 10 and 20 foot marks. As they watched, the band wavered on the screen, then began creeping slowly, inexorably upward.
"The water's back to 15 feet.